Yes, the week that was in this economy, of course. We'll do some gas and oil as well. And then, Broadway. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, today the 18th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So much to talk about at the end of the week, so little time. So in we dig. Neela Richardson is at Edward Jones. Sadeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Hi, Kai.
So Neela, let me start with you with this observation. We are now a week plus or minus since the president announced he had made what I think is being called a phase one trade deal with China. Still much to be papered over, as the president says, or papered, I guess, not papered over. Does it feel any different out there?
It feels like we're back in April, like the summer didn't happen. We are at a phase one stage. I've heard it called a mini deal, a deal light. But however you call it, basically the hard stuff has been avoided in this deal. We're back with China buying some agricultural goods, but the big ticket items are still needing to be negotiated, like removing those tariffs. That's a deal breaker from China, as we know. There's still a growing list of blacklisted companies from China who cannot do business with U.S. firms. And for the U.S., it's really about IP protection and making sure that the U.S. companies can compete in China on an even playing field. You know, this is not going to be a deal that gets comprehensively negotiated in a matter of weeks. I think we have a long term ahead in terms of trade talks.
Sudeep, do you suppose that the difficult things get dealt with in a timely manner, or does the president, as he seems to have done, declare victory and depart the field?
The president needs to declare victory, and he knows he needs to do something to be able to declare victory. He needs to be able to go to all these rallies saying, I fought China and got a deal. The rhetoric matters more a year before the election than the reality. But the reality is not good. The things that have changed in the last few months were flashing yellow lights turning into flashing red lights on manufacturing. Right. These are like alarming figures. The soft data, the sentiment surveys that we've seen from factory sector executives were already weakening for the last month or so. And now in just the last week, we've seen the hard data, the actual figures on manufacturing, go into a downturn into negative territory for the first time in 3 years. This is not good. Good for a president who's banked it all on rescuing the factory sector.
Well, so look, about those realities, and let's give a shout out to Ben White for a nice piece he did in Politico earlier this week about manufacturing and the recession that it is in this country. But Neela, the question then goes to you, and it's something we've talked about a lot the last 6-8 weeks on this segment of the program on Fridays. The American consumer, which has been the linchpin of this economy for a very long time now, are they now finally maybe out of gas? Retail sales were down in September. What do you think?
I think they still have some gas in the tank. And the reason why is that we're still seeing a very strong and healthy labor market. Those wage growth is decelerating, and that's an area of concern. We're seeing consumer balance sheets keep up pace. We're not seeing a lot of debt, pretty high savings rate. So the consumer is still relatively resilient. Consumer confidence is starting to stagger a little bit, but it's still high if you look at historical averages. The question going forward, though, does the consumer keep having to go at it alone? Right. Do we really want the consumer to be the only game in town? Personally, I'd like to see some business investment, CapEx spending, infrastructure spending to help the consumer out.
Yeah, the short answer is we don't want the consumer beating the only game.
Right.
All right, so Sudeep, let me turn to you in the minute and we have half we have left. You get half of that and Neela gets the other half. We have been talking a lot around here about what to do about impeachment coverage and what it's going to do to the economy and whether what we're just looking at is, in a nutshell, more uncertainty. As you sit there in Washington, how do you see this economy and the next like 3 to 6 months, depending on what Congress does?
So right now, the hard data, as you were saying, on consumers, the unemployment rate is remarkably good. That is very solid. But you're starting to see sentiment surveys, the early indicators weaken, and malaise from Washington discord among elected officials. We've seen the damage that can cause over time if it's sustained, and we're already seeing people get a little gloomier about the economy. Of course, we should always watch what they do and not what they say, and they're doing things that are pretty are just fine right now. But if they're starting to go into their shells and worry about a downturn, then it's just a little spark that can send it all crumbling down. And that's the fear at the moment.
Neil, a half a minute to you. Impeachment and this economy. Go.
The economy is growing, but it's growing at a slower pace. And obviously, political conflict in D.C. doesn't help that growth. But what you've seen is in the last two recessions we have, we don't have a lot of evidence, that the economic fundamentals matter more than the political process when it comes to stock returns. During the Nixon impeachment process, stocks declined, but the economy was in bad shape. During Clinton, stocks actually went up because the economy was in good shape. We have a slowing but growing economy. Expect to see stock returns inch forward and the economy keep inching along.
All right. Neil Richardson at Edward Jones, Sudeep Reddy at Politico. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend, everybody. On Wall Street today, three words, people: Boeing and Johnson & Johnson. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been talking a lot about IPOs this year, mostly the ones that haven't gone so well, Uber or that got postponed, WeWork. Here's another one. Saudi Aramco, the state-run oil giant over there, is said to be sliding its initial offering, which has been valued at as much as $2 trillion with a T dollars. Despite that delay, the company is still planning, it says, on issuing a prospectus, details of what's going on under the financial hood, if you will. A prospectus like that is pretty important for any IPO, but for a state-run company of this size, would-be investors are going to be paying extra close attention, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
Despite the fact that Saudi Aramco is the world's biggest energy company, Johns Fakianakis at the Gulf Research Center in Riyadh says people don't know much about how the company works.
This is a company that for many, many decades was closed, secret, a black box that very few people were privy to.
That's why investors will be paying close attention to Aramco's prospectus. Jay Ritter at the University of Florida says the prospectus should shed light on the company's profitability and long-term risks.
It's designed to include information that investors want to know in deciding how much to pay.
Saudi Aramco has been opening the hood a little. It had its first earnings call in August. It also revealed how much it pays to extract oil. Still, Ben Cahill at Energy Intelligence says it'll be a challenge for Aramco to answer some of the bigger questions investors have.
What investors really need to know about Saudi Aramco is the relationship between the company and the state.
Cahill says Aramco's so big, it basically is the Saudi Arabian economy. And after the IPO, the government will still own most of the company. Johns Fakianakis says investors also want the prospectus to address how last month's attacks on Aramco's oil facilities affected production.
That has to be very clear because investors want to know that the company is solid and they're able to maintain production after the attacks.
Sfakianakis says delaying the IPO will give Aramco more time to address the attacks in the prospectus. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Speaking of that Saudi Aramco IPO, as we were, and its main end product, gasoline, of course, you would be hard-pressed to find a single thing that consumers keep a closer eye on than its price.
So I normally pay about $25, $26, and it was $29.30.
For over $4 a gallon. Usually paying about $3.50, $3.75, something like that.
I think a typical tank of gas for my SUV probably went from about $48 or $50 to about $55, maybe.
So that was Trini Lamelli, Scarlett Atkins, and Ken Mason here in downtown Los Angeles. The setup for today's installment of our series, Kai Explains.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
You recently asked what's going on with this economy.
So how do these two concepts work together?
Today, how exactly does the price of a barrel of oil translate into what we pay at the pump? The benchmark American crude is called West Texas Intermediate, WTI for short. We, the United States, that is, pump about 12 million barrels of oil a day. Price-wise, crude accounts for 53% of the cost of gasoline, so says the Department of Energy, and we need a lot of it, oil, that is.
The United States both exports crude oil and imports crude oil.
That's Amy Myers Jaffe. She's a senior fellow for energy and the environment at the Council on Foreign Relations. In addition to the 12 million barrels a day we produce, we also import about 7 million barrels a day. Canada for most of it, Saudi Arabia, Mexico, and Venezuela for most of the rest. So if there is a shortage in one of those places,
because there was a military event or some other kind of disruption,
like last month in Saudi Arabia,
the price of oil in the United States also goes up.
Because oil is a globally traded commodity.
When the attack occurred, we saw an immediate jump up in pricing.
That's Tom Tsang. He's the director of the School of Energy Economics at the University of Tulsa. He is talking here about pricing on the New York Mercantile Exchange.
These are the buyers and sellers of the future delivery of things like gasoline and heating oil.
Futures contracts, that is, including that U.S. benchmark, West Texas Intermediate.
People were just, you know, buying these contracts up out of fear. We saw a $6 to $8 per barrel increase in the price immediately.
Because oil futures contracts are practically the definition of volatility.
It's referred to as rockets and feathers.
Mason Hamilton there. He's a senior petroleum markets analyst at the Energy Information Administration.
Rockets being when the price of oil goes up, the price of gasoline shoots up like a rocket.
And
when the price of oil comes down, the price of gasoline comes down like a feather.
Because
as a gas station owner, you're not thinking about what you have in your tank already. You're thinking about your next tank.
So back to the pricing. After buying the crude, which remember is about 53% of the total cost, it's got to be refined. That's another 12%. And then depending on a couple of different things like emissions regulations, the local weather, actually, in point of fact, there are different regional gas formulas and prices too.
Think of it like a cocktail. So in New York, you have Manhattans, and in Miami, you have rum and cokes, and in New Orleans, you have Sazeracs. In different parts of the country, your gasoline formula will also vary just like that.
Then there's what it costs to get the gas from the refinery to the gas station, about 17% of the total.
Using pipelines, tankers, and tanker trucks.
You add in federal, state, and local gas taxes, about 18% of the total, and there you go. The parts making up the whole of the cost of a gallon of gas, which this week, says the U.S. Department of Energy, is $2.63 a gallon, regular unleaded. Do us a favor, let us know what you are curious about in this economy, what you want explained. You can do that at marketplace.org, or you can tweet at me. I'm at Kai Ryssdal. That's K-A-I-R-Y-S-S-D-A-L. They make me spell it out for you. The ratio of talk to hype for the next generation of wireless technology, it's fifth generation, so 5G, has been basically even, right? Lots of talk, lots of hype, because the promises being built around this thing are not small. And if you haven't been paying attention, you might want to start, because one of the world's biggest chip makers, which, by the way, makes the semiconductors inside every iPhone, goes by the name of TSMC in Taiwan. And it says semiconductor orders for 5G phones and 5G networks are booming and that sales are going to take off next year. Marketplace's Scott Tong looks into what that might look like.
Superfast 5G networks will first arrive in big cities in Asia, Western Europe, the U.S., and early experiences will likely be on phones. Early adopters will buy 5G smartphones, download movies, say, 2 or 3 or 5 times faster, and get better gaming, says Avi Greengart at Techxponential.
So when you tap the screen to shoot, you won't be killed by someone else because their connection is better.
Non-phone uses of 5G will probably wait.
Will we see cars talking to other cars? May not happen next year. It may not happen 5 years from now.
In the next year or two, it'll take time for telecom firms to build 5G networks. When they do, analyst Bill Meneses at Gartner thinks entertainment firms will try to lure customers with special 5G experiences. Say you go to a football game.
You could get an augmented reality view of the game, so you have every player's movement tracked from the previous play, so you can kind of get an instantaneous, detailed replay of what just happened on that big touchdown.
By the end of next year, he thinks 22% of phone sales will be 5G phones. But all that optimism assumes some 5G killer app we all want. If it doesn't come, consumers might not pony up for 5G phones and service, says Lindley Gwenap at the Lindley Group.
If you're paying more for the phone and then an extra $10 a month for, you know, your 5G service. Is this really worth it?
He says the 5G industry's approach is to build it and hope consumers come. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Sure, and I'm a mime and a juggler.
Show business is a business, people. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 255 points today, 0.9%, 26,770. The NASDAQ dropped 67 points, 0.8%, 8,089. The S&P 500 slipped 11 points, 0.3%, 2,986. For the week, the Dow down 0.1%, the NASDAQ up 0.4%, the S&P 500 down about 0.5% on that one. Johnson & Johnson is recalling a single lot of its baby powder in the U.S. That is after the Food and Drug Administration found trace amounts of asbestos in one bottle that was purchased online. J&J lost 6.2%. Boeing off 6.8% today on news. It misled the FAA about what it knew when about the 737 MAX. Both of those companies, by the way, part of the Dow 30, which explains the Dow. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Last week, Midtown Manhattan, 44th Street, just off Broadway.
That's Kai Rizdahl.
Hey, I'm Kai. Nice to see you. How are you?
Good to see you.
Thanks for coming. Mid-morning in a restaurant not yet open for the day.
Right into this. I want you to tell me who you are and where we are.
Okay. I'm Eva Price. I'm a Broadway producer. And we are in Sardi's, which is a famed Broadway restaurant known for its lunch and dinners and post-work bar.
Home of the Tonys, right? Isn't this where they started?
Yes.
Yes. See?
You do.
Sardi's is also known, maybe mainly known, actually, for the hundreds and hundreds of caricatures of theater celebrities hung on the wall.
There are. I was actually just looking at how many I could identify, and it's not really very many.
How are you doing?
Terrible. I got Liz Smith, I got Carol Burnett, and I got Neil Patrick Harris. That's it.
Liz Smith is a good one.
Yeah. It looks exactly like her. That's how you know.
Yeah.
It's not outside the realm of possibility that someday there is going to be a caricature of Eva Price there, too.
What do you know what the qualifications are to have gotten a caricature here?
Well, I think it's like, a mix of you had to make some sort of mark on the Broadway season. It doesn't hurt to have an interesting set of features.
She's got 18 Broadway producing credits to her name, and when an edgy new version of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma won the Tony this year for Best Revival of a Musical, Eva Price was the one who accepted the award.
Does it ever get old, you saying that you're a Broadway producer?
Never. Not once. Sometimes I get sheepish because I'm...
Come on, you're like a Tony Award-winning Broadway producer.
I know, but I feel like if I say it, people will be like, sure, and I'm a mime and a juggler. Like it just kind of... It kind of sounds ridiculous.
It has been, 15-ish years that you've been doing this?
Yeah, my first Broadway credit was in 2006, so I'm at 13 years, bat mitzvah age.
For real? Is there a ceremony now?
In 2020 will be sort of the 15th year since I began. I was working at ABC News when I started theater producing, and I was there.
And you just quit, right? You wanted to do theater? Because why?
One of the things I said to my parents when I told them I was leaving my six-figure year job at ABC News and a career.
And your parents were like, oh my God.
I don't want to wake up in 20 years and maybe die and find out I didn't take a chance doing this thing that I always wanted to do. So though most producers that I knew were 20, 30 years older than me, there's no guarantee I was going to get there. So why not do it then at 26 years old and give it a shot?
Day in, day out, what do you do? It sounds like a flip question, but
I'm laughing because it's a great question. My mother asks the same question. I equate it a little bit to the CEO of a company. So it's big picture. It's everything from raising the money and acquiring the rights to the show you want to do to having a vision for how it should exist. And that doesn't mean down to how it should exist on the stage in detail. Right. That's the director's vision. But it's your vision that says this property matched with this artist for this audience is something that I want to make happen.
How do you know when there's a property or an idea or a play or a show that you want to do? How do you know?
I feel it. I know that sounds really woo-woo. Really, really even fake, but it's not. It is a blood coursing through my bones kind of feeling. It is a punch in the gut kind of feeling, slightly coupled with, if someone else produces this, I will be very jealous of them.
Yeah, for sure.
It is all of those emotions wrapped up that tell me this is the one to do.
Is this a good time to be a Broadway producer?
It's a good time to be my kind of Broadway producer.
Explain that a little bit.
I think it's harder to be a Broadway producer now. You are competing with more networks and studios and major organizations, major money for theaters and for properties, because look at the game. You know, Disney is a major figure here, Warner Brothers, Fox.
Well, so look, you go outside and there's a thing for Frozen and Lion King, right? And you've got Disney money behind all of that.
Beetlejuice,
right.
Tootsie.
Yep.
It's true.
And then on top of that, I just saw a thing for Wicked, which I think I saw on Broadway like 15 years
ago.
You
did. 2003 it opened.
2003. So there's only, you know, X number of theaters. And Wicked's not leaving. Hamilton's freaking never leaving, right? So you don't physically have enough space to put your shows.
Yeah, you forgot the Wizard over on 42nd Street.
Okay. Yeah.
He's not going anywhere either.
Yeah.
So it's harder. It's harder because you're right. The real estate is finite. And I actually believe to a degree the audience is finite. The good news is that the people who may buy a ticket to Broadway is increasing. Thank you to Hamilton, and thank you to Harry Potter, and thank you to Frozen, right? And the reason why I think it's a good time for me to be a Broadway producer, my kind of Broadway producer, A, I can stand out. I'm different than every competitor we just named. I'm not a studio. I'm not Rupert Murdoch. But I also think it's a good time because the work I want to be doing is specific. I want to be telling urgent, emotional stories. And I think we're in a time right now where audiences need that catharsis.
I'm not going to ask you to speak for all of American theater, but I'm going to ask you to speak for all of American theater. Because you're somebody now, right? And you're on the board of governors of the Theater League, right?
Broadway League,
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you matter. I need you to tell me why Broadway matters.
Mm. Broadway matters so much, Kai. It matters because it is, I think, the last, if not one of the last, places where human beings don't have screens in their hand or in front of their face, can actually consume an art form while connecting not only to the art in front of them, but can connect to the 1,000 people sitting in the same room with them at the same time. And so Broadway matters for the furthering of creative excellence, but I honestly believe for the furthering of humanity.
Eva Price, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai Ryssdal. It's a pleasure.
No, truly, it was mine. This is one of those interviews where we had too much good stuff, and this broadcast only being half an hour long, well, that's what podcasts are for. There's a whole chunk about why that new production of Oklahoma hit home with her.
The Oklahoma you're describing that people see around the country and that has existed with Gordon McRae and others is from 1943, written about Americans in 1907. And the storyline, the relationship arcs are still very present today.
You can hear the whole thing on our Corner Office podcast. Just final note on the way out today. You might remember yesterday when President Trump's acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, went to the White House briefing room and said that, yes, in fact, there was a quid pro quo in the president's dealings with Ukraine. And that, quote, "I have news for everybody. Get over it. There is going to be political influence in foreign policy," end of quote. Mulvaney tried to walk all that back a couple hours later, but then today this happened on the Trump campaign website, a T-shirt with "Get Over It" printed on the front, the distinctive presidential hairdo draped over the O in over. $30 it'll cost you. So I guess they're not walking back everything, Mulvaney said. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's down 255 today, 0.9%. Boeing and Johnson & Johnson. Remember, it's a price-weighted index, peeps. The NASDAQ down 67 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 slipped 11 points, 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Pargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.